You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, how's it going?
And Lionel's cat. If we can hear Lionel's cat in the background, desperate to have his say on all the hot topics in cycling, isn't he?
I'm not sure about that. I think maybe get in out of the rain and have something to eat, probably higher up his list of priorities.
Well, listen, a dynamic start to this week's podcast.
What's the most famous cat in cycling?
Oscar Gatto.
Very good. In the history of cycling, what's the most famous cat? Is it the cat? I think it's the cat that hit Pantani and put Pantani.
Philip Gilbert.
No, put Pantani out of the Giro in 1996 in a place called Chiunzi, I think it was, in the south of Italy.
What was that cat called?
I can't remember. I think it was black, though. I seem to remember that it was black.
Of course, the Ghent 6 cat that ran on the track a couple of years ago nearly got sliced up under some wheels, but just about got away with it.
Dogs are more famous in cycling, aren't they? Our dogs' names, at least, after Operation Puerto and all that. We know more about, you know...
We do need more good cat stories, don't we?
It's something I've thought about a lot, actually.
Maybe we should do a
special... It's occurred to me on more than one occasion.
There must be some highly eccentric stories about, you know, riders who have been cat lovers, who, you know... have cats called things like, I don't know, or, you know.
Or just odd pets. I mean, Michele Scarponi, what's the story with him and his parrot?
Yeah, well, that belongs to a neighbour, doesn't it? But anyway.
Yeah, but he takes the training. Oh, sorry, yeah, cycling. Well, there hasn't been a lot of cycling, has there, this last week? There's been a hole blown in the calendar thanks to the cancellation of the Tour of Qatar. So it's been a quite a quiet week, but you've probably got us a news roundup of some description, Lionel.
I have, Richard. There has been a bit of racing, and it's really picking up now, and will basically run from now until early October without a break, won't it? I mean, we should make the most of this little, you know, gradual start to the season.
Maybe talk about cats and things instead.
As you say, though, Rich, the Tour of Qatar was supposed
to be... Qatar! And we've got Fabio Fellini as well in a minute. Almost spelt feline.
Yes.
Anyway, go on.
Yes. Brilliant. Do you think people can tell this has all been scripted? This isn't ad-libbed. Don't think we're making this up on the hoof. Anyway, Alejandro Valverde won a big race at the weekend. His home race, really, the Vuelta a Murcia in southern Spain. Used to be a stage race, now just a one-day race. But that means his season is off and running. Valverde has won a race every single year since 2003, except 2010 and 11, where he was stripped of results and also banned for doping. But it had a brief sabbatical from racing. But quite an impressive record to win a race every year going back to 2003, asterisk except those other 2 years where he couldn't race. just along the coast in Spain, or not far from the Vuelta a Murcia, was the Clásica de Almería, where Magnus Cort Nielsen of Orica Scott won. He added that to a stage win in the Valenciana stage race the previous week. Not the previous week, actually, earlier this month, wasn't it? Daniel mentioned Fabio Fellini. Italian rider won the Trofeo Leguaglia in Italy. Daniel wasn't riding for Trek Segafredo, though. He was riding for the Italian national team.
Riding for the Italian national team, yep, correct.
Why was that? Do you know why that... We've had a few people ask why that was. Was it just simply that Trek Segafredo weren't in the race?
That is correct.
Simple as that.
Yeah, and the Italian national team have done this they've entered a few kind of relatively important races in the last couple of years to give... I think they're sort of trying to do what British cycling did a few years ago, where they try to arrange camps and have get-togethers to sort of solidify a nucleus of riders that will generally make up the national team. And yeah, they do that a few times a year in races where, for example, Fellini, it's a race he's done well in before and he would have wanted to ride. But yeah, with his trade team not being entered, then he was keen to ride for someone else.
Excellent. Well, the racing is getting underway now. The Tour of Oman has started. The opening couple of stages have been won by Alexander Kristoff of Katusha and Ben Hermans of BMC Racing. The other big story from there so far is that Tom Boonen crashed on stage one. It's about 750 metres from the finish line, a touch of wheels with his teammate Yves Lampaert. He went down pretty heavily, but he was fit enough to start the second stage. So no suggestion that his final Classics campaign is under threat at all. The other two races that have started are the Tour of the Algarve and the Ruta del Sol in Portugal and Spain. Fernando Gaviria won the opening stage of the Tour of the Algarve, and Alejandro Valverde won the first stage of the Ruta del Sol. And that really was a cracking race up a hill and then down the other side to the line. A real star group. Alberto Contador was up there. Diego Rosa was up there. Who else was up there? Izaguirre was up there.
Sebastian Reichenbach was up there, and he managed the worst attack I've ever seen. I think certainly that we've already got a very strong contender for worst attack of the season.
He managed to get out of the saddle, draw level with the rider in front of him.
Diego Rosa was drilling it on the front for wild pulls. And Sebastian Reichenbach, sitting at the back, thought now's a great time to attack with Rosa riding at 40 miles an hour in the front. He sprinted. Just about got level with Rosa when his attack sort of
fizzled out,
and that was a very poor effort, I'm afraid.
Off the bike, a couple of bits of news, race route news. The Amstel Gold Race organisers have revealed that the Koberg will no longer be the sort of the final set-piece climb of the race this year.
Hooray, hooray.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, we've talked about this several times before about shaking up the finish of the Amstel Gold Race, because recently it has both finished on top of the Koberg and it's finished down the other side, really, about 2 kilometres down the other side. The descent and then the flat, and it has led to fairly formulaic racing. This year, the Koberg, the final climb of it will be 19 kilometres from the finish, so they've shaken it up a bit. And
our next crusade is the Mur de Huy, isn't it? It is, next campaign.
Yeah, to remove all summit finishes from classics. Is that what we're doing?
It's nice to freshen up the Ardennes classics, including Amstel Gold Race in that category, which do every year, and they get a shake of the head from Lionel, but That collection of three classics that come, you know, after the cobbled classics, they're all very samey, weren't they? And the same rider could pretty much target all three, and this does shake things up.
They become very samey. I mean, until 2003, I think it was, that was the first time the Amstel Gold finished on top of the hill. Before that, it just finished in Valkenburg or Maastricht, I think, before that, didn't it? So it's not as if that finishing on the hill has been some sort of, you know, decades-long tradition. It's a relatively modern thing, so they're shaking that up a bit. And finally, for the roundup, the women's tour route has been announced. Richard, you were there with Orla this morning. The 5-day race will start in Daventry on June the 7th. It will spend 4 days in the Midlands, Staffordshire and Derbyshire before a final stage in London. It will be on the same circuit, I think, that the men's tour of Britain has used in recent years. And the other good bit of news for that race is all of the top 15 teams in the world will be taking part. So it looks like that's going to have a great route, but also a fantastic field.
Well, let's go to that immediately. And we've got I recorded a cycling podcast, Femina, today with Orla Shinui and Abby Van Twisk, the drops rider. That'll be out early next week with numerous interviews and things. But while there at the launch today, I spoke to Mick Bennett, the race director of the Tour of Britain and the Women's Tour. And this is quite interesting. I mean, the Tour of Yorkshire is in a similar position where it applied for an extra day, wanted to go up to 4 days and was declined by British Cycling. Not entirely sure why. The Women's Tour also wanted to go up to 7 days. There seemed to be a lot of support for that from the UCI, but again, it was declined by British Cycling, which is odd. And Mick Bennett, you know, while being very diplomatic, seemed to be scratching his head a little bit about that. So I'll play a longer Mick Bennett interview in the cycling podcast Femina, but let's hear a little bit from Mick Bennett just about that in particular.
The process was that we had that many venues wanted it, but not sufficient days to deliver it in. And we've got four other venues, if you count the starts and the finishes. Four other venues. It's getting the date on the international calendar to give you 7 days. We'd identified two options for a 7-day tour, put it to BC. BC felt that the women's sport in this country wasn't at such a level that would warrant making the women's tour a bigger event. The UCI said the contrary of that. They wanted it to be 7 days. And then it was finding the slot to put the 7 days in. Then UCI had to support the sanctioning body, the governing body, totally respect that. And BC said only 5 days, the board of BC said only 5 days. Since then, at the World Tour Conference in Mallorca, the UCI have said we definitely want the women's tour to be 7 days. Because I think it doesn't always follow that the more stages in a stage race makes it by default a bigger event. 5 days with the level of organisation and the facilities that we throw at it, for me, make it a big event. And that could be 3 days. But the very fact that the country wants 7 days, bike riders want 7 days, all the teams want 7 days, and the UCI want 7 days. And we're a bit baffled, to be honest, Richard, as to why British Cycling won't support it. They've given their reasons, and I respect them, but I don't agree with them.
So that was Mick Bennett there explaining what he thought were the reasons behind British Cycling rejecting the request to move up to 7 days. He said they feel that women's sport in this, women's cycling in this country isn't at a level that would warrant making it a bigger event. But he said that they are a bit baffled by it and they hope to put up to 7 days next year. It is odd.
Well, it is if the organisers believe they've got the sponsorship and the backing and the infrastructure to do it. Yeah, I can understand the kind of softly approach in terms of trying to build a sport that will end up being sustainable over a long period of time. But if you've got the people who are on the ground running the race saying we want 7 days, it is odd that the governing body would, you know, not go along with that and trust them and say, well, you've run the Tour of Britain since, what is it, 2004, you've run the women's tour, it's grown gradually year on year. If you think you can do 7 days, go for it. But there we are. There's certainly the will there from Mick Bennett and his team to expand it. And as we said before, you know, the Women's Tour has got a fantastic opportunity to be the preeminent stage race on the UCI World Tour calendar, hasn't it?
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. Extremely grateful to them for their support. They will be with us throughout the year and we're going to be doing some stuff in association with Science in Sport. Look out for featurey things. I'm actually attending the bike show on Thursday, which I think this podcast might just be out, but I'll be doing an event with Chris Hoy and doing a little interview with him as well for the podcast, so you'll hear that at some point. If you want to get 20% off all Science and Sport products, go to the website scienceandsport.com and enter the discount code TCP20. That's an offer for Cycling Podcast listeners. TCP20, 20% off all your Science and Sport products.
I may well be taking advantage of that myself, Rich.
Well, you've got a trip coming up, haven't you, Lionel?
Yeah, I've got a trip coming up to some races in Belgium for what will promises to be either brilliant or a complete disaster, one or the other, I suspect.
Do you want to share with the listeners the title of this forthcoming special?
Well, our producer, Tom Wally, came up with the title. It's going to be called The Lionel of Flanders. If that doesn't get people signing up to become a friend of the podcast, I don't know what will.
Reminder, you can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. £10 for the year, more if you want to, if you're feeling generous. But £10 will give you 11 friends specials throughout the year. We've released number one, that was on the training camp with Lotto Soudal.
Yeah, I'm very encouraged by the number of people who have who have signed up so far. Really appreciate your support. But, you know, we do need as many of our listeners to give us a bit of backing as we possibly can. I think at the moment we're swimming between Sardinia and Sicily, aren't we?
Currently,
at the Giro, yeah. We're going to have to swim. That may discourage. People may now not
cling on to the boat.
We'll be stowaways in the Mega Smeralda. You know the Mega Smeralda?
How could I forget the Mega Smeralda? Moored off.
It'll be like Captain Phillips.
That was moored off Corsica in 2013, of course, at the Tour de France. No, but your support does help us to get to races, cover races. We're all off on our travels soon. I'm off to Paris-Nice. Lionel, you're off covering all the sort of lesser known Belgian races, which would be really interesting because we know the names, we don't maybe know much about the races themselves. And you're off Tech News Band as well, I think. And Daniel, you're off out to the desert last week. We had our lady in the desert, Hannah Troop, last week in Dubai. In fact, we'll hear more from Hannah today at the end of this episode. She's got a bit on the Novo Nordisk team, the diabetic team. Very interesting story. We'll hear that in the final part of this week's episode. But you're off to Abu Dhabi next week, Daniel.
Correct. Sunday. Looking forward to it.
So you'll become Our Lady in the Desert.
You'll be Our Lady in the Desert next week. I don't know why I said Our Lady in the Desert. She's now signing messages, Our Lady in the Desert. I think it's her email signature. So
brilliant.
Sorry about that, Hannah. Anyway.
Should we talk about cycling?
Well, anything catch your eye? My eye was caught by Tom Bonin at the end of the stage of Tour of Oman when he crashed. This is his final season. In fact, it's his final sort of half season, or not even half season. He's riding Paris-Roubaix. Obviously, his big focus is Flanders and Roubaix. And then he'll bow out. And you know, he went so close last year to winning, what would it be, record fifth Paris-Roubaix. And you know, when he went down heavily and at speed in Oman, I must admit, I thought, that's it, it's over for him. But he seemed okay. He actually rode back to his hotel afterwards and the injuries seemed pretty superficial.
Yeah, and he's missed a couple of classics campaigns, hasn't he, because of untimely crashes. A couple of years ago, we were all anticipating him versus Cancellara, weren't we? I spoke to him at Paris-Nice and I think 2 days later he crashed. Yeah, and we were all anticipating a big showdown between Bonin and Cancellara a couple of years ago. Cancellara, of course, has retired. So Tom Bonin is the sort of last giant of that classics era. The two of them have, you know, won so many races between them. And Bonin came so close last year to that sort of magical fifth Paris-Roubaix. Matt Heyman, of course, denied him at the, you know, right at the death, really. But Heyman's victory and Bonin's kind of, you know, his sort of deep-rooted class should warn us, really, that he could well sign off in the best way possible. It could be that he steps up onto the top step of the podium in the Roubaix Velodrome and waves off and disappears into the sunset. I mean, it would be the fairy tale ending for his career. And there's no reason why he couldn't do it, as long as he can stay upright between now and then.
Yeah, I think he has a great chance. I mean, we've seen people try this before. We've seen a few riders ride Roubaix as their last ever race. And Franco Ballerini, I think, tried it. And the late Franco Ballerini. It was the anniversary of his death this week, actually. He tried it. Yaroslav Popovic tried it last year. But I don't think we expected Popovic to win Paris-Roubaix. Bonin certainly looks like he's in very good...
Bradley Wiggins as well, of course.
Of course, of course. One of his 15 retirements.
Yeah, he finished his high-level road career brackets north of France at Paris-Roubaix a couple of years ago.
I've just had an idea for a business. We should set up a little stall in Compiègne selling Merci Roubaix t-shirts or undervests for riders to put on.
Very
and then
true.
Unzip and, yeah.
Very
I mean,
true.
Literally drop the mic and retire.
I don't think Daniel's that impressed by that.
But just looking at and listening to Bonin's interviews over the winter, it's been quite interesting that he obviously feels as though he can come out and say this now, that he's really always preferred Paris-Roubaix to the Tour of Flanders. Of course, he's a Belgian rider, not from the heart of Flanders. He's from the sort of Antwerp region. But as a Belgian, you would expect that to be his favourite race. It's not the case. Roubaix is also the race he's gone best in. Well, he's... if you add all of his results together and compare them with his results in Flanders. And he has a technique which is more suited to Roubaix probably on the bike. So he's under no illusions about what the race he wants to win this year before he retires is. And, you know, obviously going to be extremely motivated. But as you say, it's also about staying upright between now and then, which is no foregone conclusion. The other race, of course, which I'm sure he would love to win and he's never won, is Het Nieuwsblad, coming in 10 days. And that's the real anomaly on his palmarès, the fact that he's never won that race.
Yeah, it's very odd, isn't it, that he hasn't won that race. And I'm sure he would love to. He's been close numerous times, hasn't he? A couple of years ago, the famous mugging by Ian Stannard when there were three quick steps with Stannard and Bonin, not at his best. And I think, you know, the thing about Paris-Roubaix last year was, I think most of us felt or thought that we were seeing a Tom Bonin really in decline, and that he'd been gradually declining for a couple of years. It was a surprise to see him so strong at Paris-Roubaix last year, and watching that you felt it was his best chance. But the measure of Bonin was in his response to that. You know, he was very magnanimous, very generous towards Matt Heyman, who was a surprise winner and really stole Bonin's thunder. But he's an affable guy, isn't he? He's always been a very good interviewee. We've had him on the podcast before. He'll be missed because he's combined that star quality. He's been a big star for a long time, you know, world champion in 2005. He's been a star for a long, long time. There's been a lot of pressure on him in Belgium, but he's always been extremely approachable.
Yeah, he has. And I mean, he's been a great ambassador. One or two unfortunate off-the-bike incidents aside, he's been a fantastic ambassador, certainly in his dealings with the press and so forth. But just on that race last year, Rich, I just wonder how much he already rues and will rue in the future. Not the second place per se, but if you remember the final kilometers of last year's race, he rode very, very aggressively. And I remember he sort of rationalized it at the time, he justified it, and he said that Heyman, it didn't really matter what he did in the finale last year, Heyman was probably the strongest and going to be the strongest in the sprint. But to see him attacking on numerous occasions as they rode into the Roubaix Velodrome, it was difficult to avoid the conclusion that he would have had a little bit more energy and he would have probably done a slightly better sprint if he'd ridden a bit more conservatively. And that could have been the difference between him winning and losing.
Did smack with somebody who'd lost confidence in his sprint, which used to be his weapon. And one of the things, I suppose, with age is that the speed goes a little bit. The irony being there that he was beaten by an older man, Matt Heyman. But he, you know, it's not a sprint really in the Velodrome, is it? It's a bit of a drag race, especially last year.
Yeah, and it's easy to say now when you look at the results. But I mean, he was going into the Velodrome with Ian Stannard, who, you know, not a strong sprinter. Seth Van Mark, also not a strong sprinter. And Matt Heyman, you would have, if you had to bet your house on it, you would have put all your, you know, stake on Boone and winning that. So did he need to make those moves? You know, it's very easy in hindsight to say he made mistakes, but you know, he could only do what he could do at the time. You know, you can't race the race twice, can you?
You cannot. Anything else catch your eye? I mean, we were talking earlier on about this time of the year, a few weeks into the season, we're always looking for, obviously, teams that are hot and teams that are not, because sometimes, you know, a bad start to the season, it can become a sort of pattern, can't it?
It can. I mean, this is one of your themes, Daniel, about teams getting off to a flyer, and Quickstep really have got off to a flyer because they've got three riders, Marcel Kittel, Fernando Gaviria, and even Max Richesi, who are finishers who can rack up wins, particularly at this time of year when there are so many sprint opportunities. I mean, it must be 50 or 60% of the race days so far have been sprint finishes, which offers up a lot of opportunities if you've got men that you can spread around the races as they can. I mean, what has really struck me so far is the number of top riders, big name riders, that are already looking pretty good. Valverde's off the mark winning. Nairo Quintana is racing. He's going to carry on racing in... he's going to Abu Dhabi, I believe, isn't he, Daniel?
He is, yep.
You know, we're seeing the good riders hitting the ground pretty early. Perhaps the exception to that, we haven't yet seen anything from Vincenzo Nibali, but maybe we will as the Tour of Oman unfolds this week.
Yeah, and it's a real theme over the last few years. It has been a real theme. I was speaking to an Italian colleague earlier today, Marco Bonarigo, and we were talking about Milan-San Remo, looking forward to that. And you know, talking about the course and the fact that it's not going to change again this year. And I actually also spoke to Mara Venue, the race director, today, and he confirmed that it's not going to change. And he's sort of reconciled himself to the idea that Milan-San Remo should be predominantly a sprinter's race or a race for sort of the sprinter punchers. But Marco Bonarigo was saying that, you know, there is this misconception about Milan-San Remo that about the reasons why it's become such a sprinter-friendly race. I mean, he was saying that the main reason in his eyes is that there used to only be 20 or 30 fit riders come the middle of March. There were sort of 15, 20 real star riders who were already in good form at that time of year, but their domestiques weren't in particularly great form. They were still, you know, they were only sort of 2,000, 3,000 kilometres into their annual quota of kilometres of riding. And they were still very much easing into the season. And so it was quite difficult to control that race in the middle of March. Whereas now, of course, you know, everyone is firing on all cylinders from February and everyone's picking their sort of Classics A team or their Milan-San Remo A team. So it's very difficult to break the deadlock in that race, as well as all the other factors, of course. You know, technology, I think, has had a massive impact on that race. But and certainly looking ahead to San Remo, the first big one-day race of the season, you know, some names already making themselves or have been prominent early in the year. Magnus Cort Nielsen is one who I'm very much looking forward to seeing at Milan-San Remo. If you were going to build a Milan-San Remo type rider, you would build a rider with exactly his characteristics, good climber and very, very fast. And Gaviria, of course, who probably should have won Milan-San Remo last year, but crashed on Via Roma about 400 metres from the line.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is you've got big riders not coming up against one another necessarily at the moment, but the races really begin to lead towards Milan-San Remo, don't they? I mean, next weekend, Het Nieuwsblad and Koerner, Brussels-Koerner will be the start of the Belgian classic season. And then you've got Paris-Nice and Tirreno-Adriatico, where really the classics type riders split into two groups, don't they? And the majority of the Milan-San Remo riders will do Tirreno-Adriatico, we imagine. And then everything kind of leads, you know, it's like an arrowhead, the season leading towards. And so perhaps it's not a surprise that we're seeing, you know, Kittel winning in the desert, Christoph winning, you know, Gaviria winning, you know, Mark Cavendish hasn't won a race yet, but it's looking pretty handy. You know, everyone's preparing their own particular way, and they will be brought together by Milan-San Remo in, what is it now, 5 weeks' time.
Can I ask a question?
Go on.
Okay, that big opening weekend in Belgium, which we'll preview properly next week, Het Nieuwsblad and Koerner, Brussels-Koerner, they are, you know, in a similar part of the world, Flanders, you know, the cycling heartland in Belgium. It's a very different atmosphere at those two races. I know Het Nieuwsblad, previously Het Volk, has a long history and you know, iconic finish and so on, but it's such a big event. It feels like the whole of Flanders is out watching that. It is only just behind the Tour of Flanders in terms of the feel of it. Koerner Brussels-Koerner feels like a club race by comparison.
It does.
Why is that? Do you know?
I don't know. No, historical reasons, perhaps. I mean, maybe because Het Nieuwsblad is now part of the Flanders Classics organisation, and Koerner Brussels-Koerner is still organised by a bike club. I mean, and also is in Ghent, which is a big town, and Koerner is really a suburb, isn't it? It's not. It's a suburb of Kortrijk, really. So yeah, and there is that sense that Het Nieuwsblad is the real opening of the cycling season, certainly as far as the Belgians are concerned. And Koerner Brussels-Koerner, because it comes the next day, is a sort of consolation prize if you've not done so well in the big one on the Saturday.
Whoever you are, whatever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Thank you very much once again to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast. Wonderful partners that they are. And I mentioned we're doing stuff with Science Sport. We're doing stuff this year with Rafa as well. They're sponsoring us all year. Lionel, you'll be sporting some spring range Rafa gear in your Lionel Flanders adventure.
I may well be, yeah. I should point out that I have bought some Rafa gear as well with my own actual money. I'm just taking freebies.
Oh, impressive.
You know, just you know, in the interest of transparency there.
Thanks for that. well, listen, I mentioned Our Lady in the Desert, Hannah Troop. She was out in Dubai at the Dubai Tour, and we heard about the Aqua Blue team last week. They've carried on, actually, being very, very active and very visible in the races they've been riding, getting men in breaks and so on. We've seen a lot of Aqua Blue. She also spent a bit of time with the Novo Nordisk team, which has been around a few years. Used to be Team Type 1. It's sponsored by a diabetic company, a team made up of diabetics. Very interesting project. They do want to ride the Tour de France. That's their aim. Doesn't every team?
Nice kit as well.
Yeah, nice kit and an interesting story. So, you know, a team that we've been aware of, I think, for several seasons, but not really ever known too much about. I take an interest in this as well, because a good friend of ours, Daniel, you're a friend of Roddy Riddle as well, former Scottish international cyclist, type 1 diabetic who takes on lots of extreme challenges and so on. He did the Marathon des Sables a couple of years ago. He's training for another event coming up. You know, he's certainly got me interested in this subject, in diabetics competing at a very high level. So Hannah Troop spent a few days talking to those guys and put together this report from Dubai. Here she is with Novo Nordisk.
My name is Vasily Davidenko, and I'm general manager of Team Novo Nordisk, and also I'm a sport director.
What was kind of the rationale behind setting up the team and what it actually does?
Well, in 2008 I met Phil Sutherland, founder of the team, and we spoke a little bit, and he's like, I have diabetes, and my dream is to be a Tour de France one day, and could you help me? well, he's an amazing person. He has diabetes since he's 7 months old, and that was an amazing dream for him. I grew up in the cycling, been in cycling for a long time, and I had no idea about diabetes. But when I started to get involved, I realized how important what we do. Because diabetes, if you look at our team, everyone has different story. It's not like, you know, guys been okay racing and then boom, one day they don't feel good, they go to a hospital or you have type 1. But the idea that we're going to do something very special and something very unique and something so important was inside of my head from the beginning. If we can change the world, if we can change diabetes, change vision on diabetes, we have to do it. We have this chance, we have this opportunity, we have to do it, but we have to do right. And of course, our dream is Tour de France in 2021. 2021, it looks like it's far away, but it's actually not. It's not so far away.
Hi, I'm Chris Williams. I ride for Team Novo Nordisk. I was diagnosed in the middle of a bike race. I was racing for a national team in Australia and competing in a race in Victoria. And I went into it thinking I was in good shape, but I collapsed at the end of a stage and thought it was dehydration and went to hospital, and that's when I was diagnosed. The doctor told me that I basically should hang it up. I said endurance sport like cycling and diabetes wasn't a good combination and I'd have to give it up at least for a while. So I was pretty devastated. In my mind, I'd already sold my bike. I was ready to quit cycling, and yeah, it was a massive shock to the system.
How did you kind of get over that then and then come back and decide that actually you could continue to do it?
I give my friends a bit of stick all the time, so they weren't going to let me just mope around, and they basically got me back on my bike 2 days after. As soon as I was out of hospital, they gave me a fanny bag full of jelly beans and insulin and took me for a ride. At first, I sort of realised, okay, this isn't as different as I thought it was going to be, but it's a big learning process. It was like at least 4 weeks of training and practicing managing my diabetes while I was riding before I was sort of confident enough to do another race. Back then, I was sort of by myself. I didn't know anyone else with diabetes, didn't really know what to do in certain situations, so it was a lot of trial and error. Diabetics know when they're good and when they're bad. We don't necessarily need a doctor to say, oh, you haven't been managing it too well, because we're looking at it 24 hours a day. You know, we know exactly what our numbers are all the time, so we know if we're good and we know if we're bad.
How did the peloton kind of react to you guys for a start when racing with them all?
I think at first they saw us as a bit of an experiment. We really had to earn our spot, and no one in the peloton really knows anything about diabetes, so you can't really, you know, tell them while you're riding exactly what it is. But they've seen us over the last few years, injecting while we're riding and managing our diabetes while we're riding. And some guys even come up and ask us questions in the peloton. So they've learnt that what we do, and we've got a lot more respect for it now. And I think they just see us now as another rider in the race. We don't want us to be seen as anyone different. We're cyclists first rather than diabetics that are cyclists. So we're here to race and do the best we can as well.
Hello, my name is Quentin, and I am 20 years old. I am racer for Team Novo Nordisk.
So, Quentin, the other day you had to go into anti-doping after the race, and I understand that with being diabetic, your sugars were needed sort of realigning, and you had to take insulin. What happened with the anti-doping staff?
the guy, the chaperon, the guy you need to watch me, he was next to me and he asked me, "What? You just inject something in yourself?" Once I told that it's for diabetes, and I show what it was, he told me, "Oh, okay, sorry. So yeah, everything fine. He understood.
So you have to actually inject whilst you're riding in the peloton as well?
So yeah, we have a target. Every rider have different target. If we are lower than this target, we have to eat. And if we are higher than the target, we have to take insulin. So if I have to take insulin, I take it.
How long did it take you to practice taking the insulin on the bike? That's quite an art.
You know, if we win a race, we have to put two arms in the air, so it's okay.
I'm David Lozano from Spain, and I'm riding for Team Novo Nordisk.
How did you find out first that you had started to develop diabetes?
So I was riding mountain bike and cyclocross before, and I was racing the World Cups in cyclocross, so I was losing weight, so I was kind of happy. I was feeling a little bit tired, but I was thinking maybe it's the trainings or the travels. And suddenly one day I couldn't see. I was hitting the trees, hitting the cars. So I went to the hospital and they diagnosticated diabetes.
So you actually started to lose sight then in your eyes?
Yeah, I couldn't see like the brightness of the sun or whatever. It was just black and white like old movies. We had diabetes at home for always, you know. My father is diabetic since 8 years old. I always knew diabetes was bad. And now I can say diabetes is not bad, you know. It's not that bad. But I think it's all about perspective, and it's what this team is doing, you know. Show to the people, like, we can still do whatever we want to do.
How did it go when you found out that you had diabetes? How did that work out with the team that you were riding with?
When I was diagnosed, the first thing I was trying to fix my health, and I had contract in that moment, and they preferred to stop my contract because in mountain bike you sign a guy because he's gonna do results for you, so he cannot waste money with you. So they decide to stop my contract. They stop it, and here I am.
So that must have been obviously a really hard thing to take. How did you feel when you found out about Novo Nordisk, and how did you find out about them?
When I was in the start of my honeymoon, like when you first diagnosed, I was trying to find like people like with the same condition as me, like doing sport or doing impressive things, no? And I find out Javier Mejías, and now he's my teammate. So he introduced me to Phil Sutherland, and Phil made me go to the development team, and here I am.
So after I turned the recorder off, I was speaking to Vasily, and he was telling me about when they were at one of their races, and there was a family that came over to them. Their son had only been diagnosed with diabetes about 6 months prior, and so the father was asking, "Your riders, they race with diabetes, is that correct?" And Vasily was explaining it and saying, yeah, that's exactly what we do. Vasily said, "See this guy in the break? He's got diabetes." And apparently the family spent then the rest of the day with them, and they gave them souvenirs and bottles and everything. And he explained to me how amazing it is to see young people be inspired and see that it is possible to actually still go out and compete at a world tour and an elite professional level in sport if you have diabetes and it can be managed. So it's quite an amazing team.
A very interesting piece that, Richard, and one that is topical in the sense that, this is riders who wouldn't be able to compete if they weren't allowed to take insulin and even inject themselves. You know, we've talked before about the UCI's no needles ban. Obviously, they have an exemption there. And I was surprised. I didn't realise they may occasionally have to inject themselves in races. But, of course, they have to manage their medical conditions. And, I think with the issue of medication for legitimate medical conditions in cycling has been in the spotlight so intensely after the Bradley Wiggins story broke that one of the natural reactions is to say, well, just ban all medicine and problem solved. But then you hear and find out a bit more about the Novo Nordisk team and realise that, you know, if you want to bar people from sport who have certain medical conditions, that would be one way to do it. And, you know, would that be an acceptable response? No, it certainly wouldn't.
And as Hannah said at the end there, you know, they are beacons, if you like, the genuine inspiration for the many diabetics that there are. You know, that having diabetes is not necessarily a barrier to competing or, well, first, doing sport, because I think that's an issue, a hurdle that diabetics have to get over in the first place. They can do sport, but also compete at a very high level. Alex Dowsett, of course, is another one, a haemophiliac, who has to have injections to control his condition. So, it's an interesting topic, and that was an interesting report. Do we have any other business this week at all? Anything from your end, Daniel?
One thing I just wanted to mention, I don't know whether this just passed me by because I think he announced it a couple of weeks ago, but the German rider Gerald Sierleck announced his retirement. He was only 30 years of age. He was a very, very precocious rider when he first came on the scene. He won the German national championships. He beat Eric Zabel famously at age 18. The following year, he won the under 23 world championships ahead of likes of Mark Cavendish. And after that, had a very strange career. Started very, very well, led out sprints for Mark Cavendish at Colombia in the 2008 Tour de France, and then went a very big money move to Milram, the now defunct German team that was sweeping up a lot of German talent at that time, but sort of got engulfed by the sort of aftershocks of Operación Puerto and the fallout in German cycling. And then Sihelec sort of bounced from team to team, and he pulled out a very surprising result in 2013 when he won the weather-affected Milan-San Remo. But not much else in the last couple of years, and I was just looking down at his results. I think he won about 26 races in his career. The majority of them were in Germany or German-speaking countries. He won a few stages of the Tour of Austria. And yeah, a bit of an odd one. He was a guy who, when you spoke to him, he didn't exude a great deal of sort of joie de vivre. You wondered whether he really enjoyed being a professional cyclist, but that can also be, you know, down to body language, and some people are just more slightly, they're slightly more effusive, and they demonstrate their passion for professional cycling more than others. But I'm not sure what he's going to do now. 30 is quite, it's quite an early age at which to retire for a professional cyclist, isn't it?
Yeah, I remember an interview, I think you did, Daniel, with him and Mark Cavendish together when they were both starting out, and they were very much contemporaries and believed to be sort of equivalent talents, weren't they?
They were, and at that time, Sihelec even seemed to be, he seemed to be a much more versatile rider than Cavendish. He seemed to have a lot of potential in classics as well. And I think he was a little bit indecisive about that. I remember speaking to some of his managers at MTN Quebec when he rode there, that, you know, there were times when he thought that he wanted to really target the classics. There were times where no, he decided that he was only going to be a sprinter. He also was one of those riders, a bit like Matt Goss, who was confronted with the emergence of a whole wave of rider in the sort of Sagan mold. And Edvard Boasenhagen was another one who, you know, when they first came on the scene, they really filled, they were unique in their sort of niche as being able to get over climbs and also, you know, at times win bunch sprints as well. But then all of a sudden, there was this whole army of riders in that vein. And some of them were very much compromised by that, and their careers were jeopardized by people like Sagan. And I think Sihelec really fell into that bracket and perhaps became a little bit disillusioned because all of a sudden, you know, the Sagan's Degenkolbs were a good way ahead.
Yeah, I also think, though, Daniel, that, you know, he was one of a number of riders who was really in the shade, in the shadow of Mark Cavendish at Columbia. You mentioned Goss there, you know, even Andre Greipel, you know, when they moved away, you know, they had varying success. I mean, Greipel, you know, became an A-list sprinter in his own right, whereas Sihelec went to Milram. And, you know, it's a very different thing, isn't it, being the nominated sprinter in a race like, say, the Deutschland Tour, you know, that Sihelec would have been the team leader for, and then going into the Tour de France with that Milram team. And, I mean, I remember in the 2009 Tour de France and 2010 as well, you know, their train was very visible, but hapless, really, wasn't it? And they were making mistakes day in, day out. You know, and he wasn't really the man to finish it off either. And a bit like Matt Goss, you know, you could imagine, well, these guys, once they leave and they're racing head to head with the likes of Cavendish, surely they'll flourish. But it just shows that it doesn't necessarily follow that once you move away and have the opportunities all to yourself, that those opportunities fall in your lap, because they just don't.
No, the opportunities and the burden of being on a big wage. I mean, both of those guys, Goss and Sihelec, they went to teams based in their home countries, and there's always a premium on riders like that. They're always considered to be a better bet in terms of publicity, and they're always going to get more media coverage, so therefore the teams end up paying them more in most cases. And Sihelec was on a big contract, Goss was on a big contract, and I think that's really tough when you're expected to win sprints, and like you say, you're up against guys who are just a bit quicker, the likes of Cavendish. And it gets to sort of March, April, May in a given season, and you haven't got on the score sheet yet, and I think that really starts to weigh some riders down. I think it puts them in a difficult position, and that might have been the case with Sihelec.
Good pub quiz question, though, isn't it? Who won Milan-San Remo after travelling 50 kilometres in a bus? Because he won the Milan-San Remo that was shortened because of the terrible weather. But, you know, at the end of the day, you mentioned 26 wins or so in his career, Daniel, but, you know, he won a monument. So, you know, a great result to look back on. And also, you know, that was really the moment that the Quebecer, the MTN Quebecer team, as they were, began to be taken seriously, wasn't it? They delivered a big win with a big name rider, and they've grown from strength to strength from that day on, really.
Absolutely, Lionel. It's funny, isn't it, that, you know, the stories of Chilek and Goss quite similar, both Milan San Remo winners and both sprinters who never really fulfilled their potential. But anyway, we've got all that to look forward to Milan San Remo. I mean, we did sort of preview that a bit in this episode. Don't know how that happened. This wasn't on the script, wasn't in the plan. Anyway, we should leave it there for this week. We'll be back next week to talk about a lot more racing and look forward to Het Nieuwsblad, where you will be also, Lionel. You're going to that. You'll be in Abu Dhabi next week, Our Lady in the Desert.
I will be. When? Am I going to report from there? Probably.
I hope so.
I'm going to report back. I'm going to come up with a cracking cat-related anecdote for next week.
You got a week to think about that and to do some research into that in the desert. We'll look forward to hearing from you from there, Daniel. But in the meantime, for this week, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.